Funding for Think comes from the SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
Of all the new and serious threats the United States has faced since 9/11, one challenge came from within. The dangerous disconnect between federal agencies charged with protecting national security at home and abroad. From KERA in Dallas-Fort Worth, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The effort to fight the real bad guys required nothing less than a radical restructuring of how elite military squads, the FBI, CIA, the NSA, and others viewed their roles and responsibilities, their claim on the intelligence they generated, and their comrades in other departments. My guest is here to tell us how they did it and how this new era of collaboration has made them stronger collectively and individually. James Kitfield is senior fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. His new book is called Twilight Warriors, the soldiers, spies, and special agents who are revolutionizing the American way of war. James, welcome to Think.
Happy to be here.
Who and what caused the kind of entrenched divisions between different agencies that existed between the late 90s and the early 2000s?
Well, I think that during the Cold War, with such a massive, you know, federal government, that these agencies kind of each went into their own corners. So the FBI handled domestic criminal issues. The CIA was left to handle international intelligence, NSA, primarily international snooping on communications. The military itself has a number of sort of separate fiefdoms in each of the armed services. So in sort of a Cold War construct, that you know, worked okay until we started to see, especially in the early 1990s, end of the Cold War, a lot of these non-state actors started gaining more and more power and exploiting these gaps between our agencies. The first were the drug cartels who, you know, crossed many agency boundaries as they moved product from South America up to the United States. Had a couple of cartels, the Medellin and the Cali cartels, became so powerful they threatened the democracy of Colombia. So that's when we first started to see these non-state actors get very, very powerful and exploit these gaps between our intelligence, law enforcement, and military agencies. And then, of course, we started to see al-Qaeda emerge in the 1990s, and the terrorism threat sort of mirrored what happened with the drug cartels, exploiting these gaps between our agencies.
Were those interagency rivalries responsible for the failure to foresee and maybe mitigate the catastrophic attacks of 9/11?
Yeah, I mean, that was certainly the conclusion of the 9/11 Commission report. You know, the CIA knew that some of the 19 hijackers were in the United States, had every indication that they were in the United States. They were the ones who had been surveilling them overseas in Kuala Lumpur and places where they were meeting. Didn't share that information with the FBI. The FBI, in its hand, knew that there were some nefarious people taking flight lessons at various flight schools and acting strangely, but didn't know that they were tied to al-Qaeda. So the failure to sort of share that intelligence and connect the dots was certainly cited as from the 9/11 Commission report as a chief reason why that plot was successful.
Just before we move on, I want to talk about like the reasons why the same, you know, agencies working for the same country, the same government, were so disinclined to trust and respect one another. Like, what made them so culturally different from one another from an organizational standpoint?
Well, I mean, probably the biggest divide would be from the FBI and the CIA, which is, you know, back when I was doing reporting, even in the 1990s, were described to me by senior FBI officials and CIA officials as, you know, two cities on separate hills. Hmm. You know, the FBI has a culture that is very much comes out of the police culture and the, you know, so rule of law, going by the book. You know, looking to get evidence to use in a court of law. CIA, just the opposite, Tweedy Georgetown types who are all about breaking the rules to get the information that our policymakers need to make, you know, top-level decisions. So they sort of played to type. The Tweedy Georgetown CIA guys looked down their noses at the sort of beat cop FBI and vice versa. The CIA thought that they were unsophisticated. The legal attaches at embassies where they were seemed much lower than the CIA chief of mission at our embassies. So there was just this culture of competition and really sort of disregard that had been allowed to fester. And it caused them huge problems, which they had started to try to address already in the 1990s by putting an FBI liaison at the CIA and vice versa on issues like counterterrorism. But it didn't work fast enough. I mean, that 9/11 plot was already in the works.
Hmm. So once 9/11 happened, and then we are in these really challenging wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's clear to so many people involved that something significant needs to change. Recognizing that and figuring out exactly what should happen are two very different things. Can you talk a little bit about the folks involved in forging really a whole new way of doing things?
Well, when we went into Iraq, for instance, or in Afghanistan for that matter, but especially Iraq, we had very little sort of intelligence insight into what we were getting into. And the military ended up in this sort of environment which it had no familiarity with, not even sure who the enemy was, enemy that didn't wear a uniform, could hide in plain sight. So they were facing this insurgency that was getting worse and worse and, didn't really know who they were fighting. So that forced them, to think about, okay, we have to take intelligence much more seriously. As it turned out, that the perfect crucible for sort of this effort of breaking down the barriers of culture and these walls between the agencies were the Joint Special Operations Command's task force, multi-agency task forces. Joint Special Operations Command has a lot of autonomy. It was the organization tasked with killing or capturing the top Al-Qaeda in Iraq terrorist leaders. They needed intelligence badly. They needed to know how to gather intelligence. So they sort of forged this team effort that basically wrang whatever synergy they could out of all the various players. And it was all the intelligence agencies. It was the FBI. It was our special forces, direct action groups like Delta Force and SEAL Team 6. And really almost achieved something like the holy grail of government, which is a whole of government effort. Now, albeit one focused very directly on hunting terrorists, basically.
What is F3EA?
F3EA is what is the shorthand for this really high operations tempo style of operations that they came to adapt. And it reflects both this incredible operations tempo and also the importance of intelligence. So it stands for find, fix, finish the terrorist, and then exploit and analyze. So F3EA. And the exploit and analyze almost became more important because it empowered the find and the fix. For the longest time, just being able to hit an enemy that we knew where it was a great challenge. In a counterinsurgency, counterterrorism environment, just finding them is the chief challenge. So, for instance, the task forces kind of turned intelligence gathering on its head. And, previously in military doctrine, you gather intelligence to enable operations. In F3ENA, you are launching operations to gather intelligence that then empower more operations. So it's a virtuous sort of circle or cycle. And they went from launching maybe five of these night raids against targeted terrorists a month to over 300 at the height of the war. Just shows you how it sort of built on itself. The more you raided these places, the more information you got, the better you got at exploiting that information, which would identify more targets. And that sort of ethos grew to expand well beyond JSOC task forces in Iraq and Afghanistan to encompass the entire counterterrorism network, which is global at this point.
Have there been times when different agencies trying really hard to collaborate still, the Venn diagram includes an overlap of things that both agencies might ordinarily intend to handle on their own?
So are there still sort of disconnects? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, this is not perfect. These are human beings and these agencies, and particularly now with the war in Iraq sort of having wound down for a period and the drawdown in Afghanistan, almost complete, a lot of the old habits can come back into play where you're told by your civilian masters you're in a peacetime environment, that it's wartime mindset's no longer necessary. So, yeah, there are times when you've seen some of that collaboration and not be as good as it was, but one of the reasons I wrote this book is having covered the military for more than 2.5 decades, I saw something here that I hadn't seen before. And I think that we are going to need that capability going forward because I don't see the fundamental conflict we're in ending anytime soon.
I want to talk about torture, sometimes called enhanced interrogation. Whether they approve of torture ethically or not, A lot of people hear about it and intuitively have the sense that it must be effective. Can you talk about the evidence that critics have used to challenge those assumptions and how those challenges have sort of played out in, efforts like the Joint Special Operations Command?
Yeah, so I devoted a couple of chapters to this because I think it's extremely important. I mean, I was in Iraq when the Abu Ghraib scandal broke and saw how those pictures and that sort of narrative of an abusive America that was torturing people played into the hands of the narrative of al-Qaeda in Iraq. It was just an excellent recruiting poster for them. And I talked to people who knew the most about these interrogations, and they were adamant in insisting that torture gave you very corrupted intelligence, because basically if you're being tortured, you'll tell your torturer whatever he or she wants to hear. And there was this famous case, which I spent a chapter on, where it's the first senior al-Qaeda operative captured after 9/11, Abu Zubaydah, was put in a CIA secret site. But the FBI interrogation team, and that's who our traditional interrogators, interviewers are, arrived a week before the CIA team. So we had a rare case where you had the FBI approach, and then afterwards the enhanced interrogation from the CIA team. And the FBI approach, basically got all of the critical information out of Zubaydah. Particularly, he fingered Khalid Sheikh Mohammed as the mastermind behind the 9/11 attacks. This is in early 2003, so first time we had learned that, or 2002, I should say, excuse me, first time we had learned that. And he also fingered this American, that there was an American al-Qaeda operative who was plotting a dirty bomb attack. That information led to the arrest of Jose Padilla. When the CIA took over, they basically broke him psychologically, but he surrendered no new intelligence. So I don't think that the experts think that torture works, and I think they are convinced that the traditional interrogation techniques are much better.
Are CIA operatives taught to do interrogations?
No, and that was part of the synergy I talk about is agencies that don't really know each other very well being thrown into a very high-stress environment together, having to sort their way through what each brings to the table. And that's where the synergy comes from that eventually emerged from these task forces. Well, if you know what people bring to the table, the FBI brings interrogation skills to the table. The CIA has no interrogation department. It doesn't conduct interrogations. It is primarily about finding human sources and infiltrating groups and finding intelligence that way. So the CIA had to rely on these two Air Force psychologists who themselves had never done an interrogation, but they had designed a program by which our special forces guys were put through some of the interrogation techniques that the North Koreans and the Chinese had used against us in the Korean War as a way to sort of strengthen them against that kind of interrogation. So we came to rely on a couple of neophyte Air Force psychologists and an agency that had no experience really in interrogation, and shunted to the side the FBI, which was our master interrogators and interviewers. And that was a wrong turn that cost us dearly for years.
We're speaking this hour with James Kitfield. He's senior fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. His new book is called Twilight Warriors, The Soldiers, Spies, and Special Agents Who Are Revolutionizing the American Way of War. You can be part of this conversation by calling now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like Diane Jay, internationally published creative writer. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with James Kitfield, senior fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. His new book is called Twilight Warriors, the soldiers, spies, and special agents who are revolutionizing the American way of war. You can join us at 800-933-5372. James, what are Twilight Warriors as opposed to Daylight Warriors or Midnight Warriors?
I chose that title because I wanted to convey that the conflict these warriors are involved in is somewhere between victory and defeat, between mm-hmm. night and day. It's a kind of a perpetual twilight, and they have fought for a very long time, and the fight continues. And it's kind of one of the reasons I think President Obama has gone from describing al-Qaeda as decimated to saying this is a generational struggle. These guys saw firsthand the enemy we were fighting, and pretty much determined that that enemy was not defeated when Osama bin Laden was killed or any one of the other terrorist leaders, many of whom we brought to justice at this point.
How did the kind of profiling techniques used to track and understand serial killers play into our efforts to recognize those who might be inclined to do something like a suicide bombing?
So as part of this, these joint task forces, the FBI in Afghanistan and Kabul, largely under the leadership of their legal attaché at the time, who was Brian McCauley, he was at the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, witnessed a horrific car bomb that killed two American soldiers as well as a score of plus of Afghan civilians, and just saw these IED, improvised explosive devices, cells, Taliban cells in Kabul, as sort of serial killers themselves, and decided that if they're going to be killing if the serial killers are out killing Americans someplace, then the FBI should get fully invested in trying to find out who they are. So he increased the FBI presence in Kabul from a handful of agents to more than 100. He brought over the serial killer profilers from the behavioral science units in Quantico to interview would-be suicide bombers who had either lost their nerve at the last minute or whose bomb didn't go off, to try to get a profile. It's the same process by which they came to know the minds of, got inside the heads of a lot of serial killers. And they used that to understand the motivations, but also to understand who is manipulating these people, how they're being manipulated, how they're being radicalized, how they're being deployed. Discovered that the people who were first radicalizing and then deploying these people were very sophisticated, very clever about taking people who perhaps might not be very capable, very little intelligence, and using them in very rudimentary kind of attacks, but taking others who were very sophisticated and using them to set up the networks by which these people were funneled towards their target or attacked much more sophisticated, highly defended targets. So we learned a lot about both the enemy, who was controlling the enemy, and also about the motivations of people who would do this.
I'm curious about the cultural differences that may have existed. You know, you have American FBI agents who are accustomed to dealing with people who are culturally American, trying to apply those same kind of psychological profiling skills to people who come from very different places and ways of life.
Well, and that was the very purpose of those interviews, was to try to find out. They understood that they didn't bring the cultural context to understand what was motivating these people to do, you know, to take their own lives in advancement of the goals of these terror masters. So, you know, obviously the interviews were conducted in the local language through interpreters. They learned, you know, they had to study the Quran very closely to understand what parts these people were using to manipulate these people to basically commit mass murder. And it was kind of a cultural deep dive, if you will, by the FBI. And from that deep dive, I think they feel like they understood much more of the sort of ideological motivations for these people. And they used that understanding to develop further their interrogation template. And that template was used to successfully interrogate people like the would-be suicide New York Times Square bomber, the guy who was going to bomb the underwear bomber who was going to down an airplane over Detroit, the guy who was going to bomb the New York City subway, all of whom gave up really vital intelligence and were later convicted and sentenced to life.
It's fascinating that prisons turn out to be such a prime incubator for new terrorists. And this is not only prisons somehow run by the U.S. or a Western ally. These are prisons even in the countries of origin where these terrorists were raised.
Yeah, it is very interesting. I have a devoted chapter in the book to the profiling Carlos Bledsoe, who was a typical African-American kid from the South, Tennessee, who ended up being the first terror jihadist to launch an attack, a lethal attack in the United States after 9/11. And, you know, he got in trouble as a kid. And frequently in the profile of these people, you see there is some moment of truth where they're in trouble and they're looking for sort of a way out. And they land on, in this case, in a mosque maybe run by a radical imam who sets them on the path towards jihad. In Carlos Bledsoe's case, that was an imam in a local mosque in Tennessee who was very much had a hardline Salafi jihadist point of view. Sends him to a sort of jihadi finishing school at a madrasa in Yemen, where he gets further radicalized. And then he gets captured by the Yemeni authorities and put in prison. And just like so many before him and after, that was the perfect finishing school because it's a captive environment. Everyone in prison in some way is facing kind of personal ruin and looking for a philosophy, an ideology, a religion, something to sort of, get out of, this moment of personal ruin. And if you look at, right now, Al-Qaeda is led by Ayman al-Zawahiri, who spent a long time and sort of formalized his own education in jihad in an Egyptian prison where he was tortured. Same for Al-Qaeda in Iraq leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who spent time in a Jordanian prison where he was also further radicalized.
Right.
The same for al-Baghdadi, who leads ISIS today, who spent time in a U.S. detention center. So we're finding that these prisons are often perfect finishing schools for sort of Salafi jihadism.
This takes us a little far afield from what we're talking about, but as you were doing this reporting, did you think about, does this suggest different ways that we might be able to manage incarcerating people within the criminal justice system?
Yeah, absolutely. For instance, if you have someone who is a sort of Islamic extremist and radicalizer, you don't put them in the general population.
Right.
I mean, you just don't. That is the absolute wrong thing to do. You have to isolate these people to a certain degree if they continue to show these proclivities, because they are the chief recruiters for a lot of terrorists who've caused great, great damage. So that's the first thing you do is isolate these people from the general population.
So as the U.S. has adjusted its strategy, various agencies have learned to work collaboratively. This, of course, has not prevented the evolution of our enemies. Can you talk about how the fight against ISIS is fundamentally different from the effort to dismantle al-Qaeda?
So, I think if I would criticize the Obama administration for one thing, and they've done a lot of good things in enabling this this terrorist hunting network that I describe in my book, but I think I think there was a lot of support for the idea after Osama bin Laden was killed, and his top 15 or so of his top 20 lieutenants were killed in the space of a couple of years. That's when that network reached its sort of peak. General Stanley McChrystal, who was sort of the chief pioneer of it, called it hitting Amazon.com of counterterrorism at that point. The idea was, and the hope was, that that had sort of decimated al-Qaeda, and we could then go back to a new normal, pull our troops out of Iraq, which happened the same year we killed bin Laden, pull our troops pretty rapidly out of Afghanistan. And to me, President Obama made that controversial statement that ISIS was the JV team of terrorism. I think the mistake was not to realize that that these groups are not distinct distinct terrorist groups that you can pick off their leaders and take down that way. They're the core of these groups, as some intelligence people have told me, is the ideology. And whether it's the Taliban or al-Qaeda or ISIS or al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula or Boko Haram in Nigeria or al-Shabaab in Somalia, they all travel under and united by a common ideology, Salafi jihadism. And it was a mistake to think of ISIS was more like Al-Qaeda 3.0 than it was the JV Team of Terror. They had learned both from Al-Qaeda core. They adopted bin Laden's strategy of attacking the West, which we've seen with these horrific attacks in Paris and Brussels and Nice. They adopted Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula's sophistication, you know, under Anwar al-Awlaki with social media. They have an online magazine that is very similar to Inspire, which was al-Awlaki's radical jihadist magazine. They have inspired a lot of lone wolves and realized you could recruit people to do damage at wherever they are. They learned from him. They learned from Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was really the organization that ISIS evolved from, adopting this strategy of wanton slaughter, even of fellow Muslims who were of a different sect, in this case the Shia Muslims. You know, Al-Qaeda in Iraq and now ISIS has killed tens of thousands of fellow Muslims who were Shia. So it was sort of the evolution of Al-Qaeda into what I call 3.0, not the JV Team of Terror. And that was something we have to very much understand, because it will continue to evolve even after we take back its territory. And somewhere in a prison cell somewhere or in a dusty backwater, you know, Al-Qaeda 4.0 is brewing, because, you know, bin Laden and all of these terrorists, leaders who I name, I mean, they created learning organizations and they continue to learn. And they've fought us to nearly a standstill, and we're the most powerful military in the world twice in the last 10 years, once in Iraq in around 2006, and then in Afghanistan in 2009, 2010. So we should take this threat very seriously. They're very sophisticated. They're learning organizations, and they continue to evolve.
This idea of taking out top leaders and then essentially feeling like it's safe to withdraw or pull back, it makes me think about, you know, if you've been sick and you're prescribed an antibiotic, if you quit taking it before you've finished the course, you're likely to get sick again.
It's exactly right. And I think that is the teaching moment about ISIS. I mean, certainly no one was more reluctant to send troops back into Iraq or into Syria than President Obama. But he realized once, you know, ISIS had captured half of Syria, a third of Syria and a third of Iraq, that you could no longer ignore this group. You cannot let it get so powerful that it can then, you know, use all the instruments of almost a state or a caliphate, as they call it, to become more and more powerful and plot more and more deadly attacks against us and our allies. So, we have kind of learned about this group. And if you pull back, as one senior general told me, we confused walking away from a fight for winning it. And I think we've now relearned that we haven't won these conflicts. We've got them, you know. We've made great progress. We made great progress against Al-Qaeda in Iraq before we pulled out of Iraq. We're making progress even as we speak against ISIS and in the offensive to recapture Mosul and the offensive to come to recapture Raqqa. But they will not be gone the day after the caliphate basically disappears. And we're learning that again in Afghanistan. I mean, we have precipitously pulled out troops from Afghanistan. The Taliban has made major gains. And last year, they answered any question about whether they would, if they got power again, allow Al-Qaeda to once again establish bases in Afghanistan to attack us, which is what happened before 9/11. We found the biggest Al-Qaeda base since before 9/11 in Kandahar province last year, fought days-long battle to reclaim that. So walking away from this fight is not the same as winning it.
Well, if the U.S. and its allies are able to reclaim significant amounts of territory that had been snatched up by ISIS, what have we learned about, you know, assuming that we cannot kill every single person who was affiliated with ISIS in some way, what have we learned about preventing the ones who are left over and somewhat defeated from, you know, forging smaller insurgent groups?
Well, I very much anticipate that they will do just that. I mean, that's what happened to Al-Qaeda in Iraq before it blossomed into ISIS. I would just say that they were much more manageable when they had to hide in the shadows and worry about looking over their shoulders constantly, either from our own special forces or from police or whoever. So, you know, we've learned a couple of things that are very important about understanding this enemy, one of which is the conditions in which it flourishes. If you have a very weak governance or collapsing governance in a Muslim-majority country, and you have a conflict in that region, you are going to see these groups arise. I mean, that has been proven by the post-Arab Spring, where they sprouted up in almost all these places where governments collapsed or were, in the case of Libya, taken out by NATO. They flourish on conflict. They rise in conflict because they are the most determined, the most ideologically committed fighters, the most brutal fighters. So they and they see this conflict through a prism of a war against Islam. And so if you have those conditions in a Muslim majority country, they will flock to that like moths to a flame. So we now know the conditions that create these groups. We also have learned from very hard experience, you cannot allow them to take and hold large swaths of territory because they will use that to train, to recruit, to indoctrinate, and to plot plot terrorist attacks against the West.
James, in publicly underestimating the lethality of ISIS, at least in the beginning, is it your sense that President Obama just simply got it wrong, or could there have been something strategic to his sort of dismissal of their potential threat to the region and to the broader world?
You know, I think they got it wrong. I will caveat that by saying they were not alone in getting it wrong. I remember talking to Ben Rhodes, his strategic communications advisor, right after Osama bin Laden was killed. And the combination of killing bin Laden and most of his top lieutenants, and also the Arab Spring, which, if you remember back that time, was a very hopeful series of democratic revolutions. The idea was that the narrative at the center of al-Qaeda's message, which is the only way you can reclaim Arab and Muslim dignity is through violence, that narrative seemed to be being disproven every day with these democratic revolutions. So I think that they, and then once, you know, once what a, one thing you discover is when a narrative is coming from the White House, it's a very powerful thing. And after 2011, the White House ran for a year in a tough election, re-election 2012, on the idea that the president was the guy who killed bin Laden, decimated al-Qaeda, and brought ended the post 9/11 wars. And that was a very popular message. I think, and in fact, I know that, you know, people like Mike Flynn, who we now know as Trump's senior national security advisor, then the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, were seeing intelligence that suggested that we had not decimated this ideology and its converts, and that in fact the number of extremist groups had doubled between 2004 and 2014. So that intelligence never seemed to figure very prominently in the president's daily brief, which is one of the reasons that Mike Flynn was so frustrated.
Got to jump in. My guest is James Kitfield, author of Twilight Warriors, the soldiers, spies, and special agents who are revolutionizing the American way of war.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program for working professionals like Dr. Jeffrey Funk, exploring medical education for a new generation of learners. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with James Kitfield. He's a senior fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. His new book is called Twilight Warriors, the soldiers, spies, and special agents who are revolutionizing the American way of war. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org, which is where we hear from Meg in Fort Worth. Meg wants to know, James, what happens to the terrorist families once they're captured or killed? And do we do anything to mitigate the potential of them becoming terrorists as well?
The family of the terrorist?
Yes.
We generally don't do anything to them. We don't ascribe to the view that was espoused during the campaign by Mr. Trump that you kill or imprison the families and guilt by association. So, to my knowledge, we do nothing to the families. It's the terrorists we're after. And again, I don't think it's an American value to supply guilt by association.
Well, I think Meg's question is actually, how do you keep them from being radicalized by the fact that we have taken down their alleged terrorist relative?
Well, I don't know that the response to if their loved ones has turned into a terrorist. I think even families understand that that's something that society is not going to put up with. If that further radicalizes them, or if killing a family member, which is clearly, you know, an extreme thing that we do on a pretty routine basis, that can certainly radicalize others to in the family to that person's cause. I don't know what you do about that, quite honestly. I mean, you could reach out and try to talk to them. But a lot of times these people are in societies that don't have easy entry into, which is one of the reasons why we use drones. We don't have boots on the ground in the Pakistani tribal areas, for instance, or in parts of Somalia, or a lot of these other ungoverned spaces where we use these operations.
So we use drones for surveillance. Of course, we use them for targeted strikes. Who's in charge of deciding where these drones go, and who has the final say when they are used to deploy a weapon?
Well, the decision on you know, actually having someone on this targeted terrorist list, you know, assigned to either be captured or killed, is made at the level of the National Security Council, and frequently, in most cases that are outside a war zone, have to have the president's buy-in. So they're vetted at a very high level, but they have never come altogether clean with the American public about what the evidentiary bar is to be put on that list. There's a lot about this kind of style of operations that remains hidden. But that's kind of what we know, is that there are these lists. They get vetted at the very highest levels of governments. Once they're determined that someone should be targeted, depending on where they are and what legal authorities apply, if it's a country we're not at war with, it's likely to be and has a government like Pakistan, it's likely to be handed off to the CIA, which runs its own paramilitary operation, because it is much less accountable. If it's a place where there is, you are in a war zone where the military has a lot of authority to target people, or if it's in a government that we are friendly with, as was in many cases the years in the case in Yemen, then it's usually handed off to our special operations forces.
All right, let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Larry calling from Dallas. Hi, Larry.
Good afternoon. So far your analysis is pretty good, that we're engaging in micro war. So two things come from that. One, is not our huge military spending just a toy fetish fighting two wars ago, and projecting all that hardware, doesn't that cause the radicalization?
Two interesting points. On the, you know, the rest of the defense budget being on war toys, I mean, I would just dispute that characterization. You know, terrorism is not the only thing, not the only threat we face. We face the threat of a resurgent Russia that is determined to, you know, reclaim its near abroad by force of arms. We face an ascendant China that is bullying its neighbors and threatening, you know, freedom of navigation in the South China Sea. We are faced with a conventional threat, an unconventional threat also by North Korea, which within this Trump's, you know, term will probably get the ability to launch an intercontinental ballistic missile with a nuclear warhead. You know, that's not the kind of capability you like in the hands of a hermit kingdom like North Korea. So we're facing many, many threats, and I think that a lot of those drive defense spending as much so as this program. Could you remind me the second question?
Sure. Larry, do you want to, what was your second question?
Yes. Doesn't projecting this huge amount of hardware all around the world, exclusively U.S., doesn't that contribute to radicalization and anti-Americanism?
Yeah, I think the short answer is yes. The question then arises, what do you do? I would argue that, you know, we have adopted the template we are now following in places like Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan is a very small footprint template where we take the unique skill set that I've talked about here that was really developed by our Joint Special Operations Forces in conjunction with all the military intelligence agencies. and marry that to local proxy forces on the ground who are willing to fight for their own country and their own territory. That's what we're doing all over the place. We're doing that in Somalia. We're supporting an African Union force in Somalia against al-Shabaab. We're doing that in Iraq, supporting Iraqi security forces and Kurdish Peshmerga against ISIS. We're doing that in Afghanistan. We only have less than 10,000 troops left in Afghanistan, basically trying to empower the Afghan security forces to basically govern their own country. So the new template is much more small footprint. I don't think you're going to see large U.S. ground combat forces used again for the very reason that the listener cites. They were very controversial and expensive, and no one wants to do that again. So that's kind of what we're left with. I will say we didn't, in the 1990s, as we basically ignored al-Qaeda and ignored what was going on in Afghanistan, didn't stop al-Qaeda from launching ever more deadly attacks, first against our troops in Somalia, then against the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya, and then against the USS Cole in Yemen, and then finally 9/11. So and the same holds for ISIS in Iraq. We pulled our troops out of Iraq in 2011 and Iraq. That didn't stop them from basically storming into Iraq, taking over a third of the country, and then using that caliphate to train, recruit, indoctrinate, and launch attacks against the West. So, again, I don't think turning away from this conflict is the same as dealing with it.
Is there any reason for private citizens to worry about the blurring of the lines between civilian and military agencies?
Yeah, I mean, sure, there absolutely is. I mean, those lines were drawn for a reason. They were drawn mostly in the 1970s after the CIA got involved in sort of illegal assassination attempts against, you know, communist or perceived communist leaders and support for sort of military dictators in places like Chile and others. So now we've relaxed some of them. So it requires very close oversight, is what I would say. It requires very close civilian oversight. We have that to a degree with the intelligence communities in both the Senate and the House, which also flew from the same, you know, grew out of the same reforms in the 1970s. But there is a lot of this, and I have argued, one of the reasons I wrote the book is if this is going to be the new normal, I think the American public have a right to have a better understanding of what's involved here. And for a long time, the administration was pretty reluctant to provide that understanding.
What makes it more challenging than before now to monitor things like cell phone communications among terrorists?
Well, in part because the Edward Snowden revelations basically gave away our playbook. So, like I said, these are very sophisticated adversaries. They paid very close attention to what was revealed by Mr. Snowden. And adjusted their tradecraft accordingly. You combine that with the ability of Apple and others to put almost fail-safe encryption on new cell phones, and you take away a key tool that our National Security Administration Agency and others were using to connect the dots between these groups. I mean, the whole debate about collecting vast amounts of what they call telephone metadata and then querying it with, sophisticated algorithms to see connections between these various shadowy networks. That was a critical capability. We have retained it to a degree, but we've also put new restrictions on it. So I will just say that the ability to use those tools was part and parcel of this level of effectiveness that you saw. And I'm already hearing from senior intelligence people that, you know, their threat radars that used to be pretty good are going dark in certain places that leave them very concerned.
This might sound like a treasonous question, but in all seriousness, is it possible, James, to perform any kind of cost-benefit analysis of all the resources that we've spent in our effort to protect the homeland from acts of terrorism, to protect U.S. interests overseas? I mean, it's hard to put a dollar figure on this, and yet it really has been, an extraordinary focus of time and treasure.
That's absolutely true, and there's been some very 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 costly wrong turns, like the invasion of Iraq for starters. I mean Al-Qaeda was non-existent in Iraq before we invaded it. Unfortunately, we created the conditions. Now that we understand the conditions, we created the conditions that let it flourish. This cost-benefit analysis, we're spending historically high amounts on intelligence. I think the budget figure, it's been released, I think, once. It was somewhere around the mid $70 billion a year, a lot of money. And our defense budget is historically not out of whack to where it's been in during the Cold War. But I would caution that you have to, you know, weigh that against the cost of having periodic attacks like Paris, periodic attacks like Brussels, like Orlando, like San Bernardino, like 9/11. I mean, what is the cost of that? We're already seeing those things destabilize our closest allies in Europe, this leading to an anti-immigrant backlash that is basically tilting their entire politics to the right in a way that is of great concern. So there is cost to defending ourselves, and there are huge costs to not defending ourselves. Mm. I've always argued that I'd rather defend myself.
What do you think we can expect from a President Trump?
You know, I'm working on that right now, and the short answer is we just don't know. I mean, he has proclaimed so many controversial and in many cases contradictory policies that it's just difficult to know what he will do. He's got a secret plan, quote unquote, to destroy ISIS. I suspect that will involve some sort of an accommodation with Russia, who he seems much more willing to play ball with Putin than President Obama has been. So I suspect he'll try to reach some sort of accommodation that lets Russia and the U.S. Sort of focus together on ISIS. But that also requires that you kind of have to ignore what Bashar al-Assad's doing in the rest of Syria, and that's going to anger our Sunni Arabs allies like Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf Kingdom. So, you know, he's talked about going back to waterboarding and worse. That would be an absolute disaster. Talked about, you know, banning all Muslims. Plays right into the narrative of the terrorists that there's a war between Islam and the West. He has since amended that to say, no, we're just going to have super vetting against people coming in from these war zones. That's a much more defensible argument. I'm not sure, you know, you could argue both sides of that, but at least it's more defensible because we've seen with Europe that if you just let vast amounts of migrants in, there will be some percentage of them that are going to probably be ISIS or be jihadists. And so more vetting against groups that come in from war zones, I mean, I think you can certainly argue that might be that might not be misguided. But it's very hard to say. I mean, he has said so many things that I don't really believe he fully intends to follow through with, that it's difficult to know where he'll eventually come down.
Do you think there's a danger of resegregation of these agencies and military teams that have worked together relatively successfully over the past few years?
I absolutely do think there's that danger. I mean, I just recently did an article about, there was a case that your listeners may remember very recently before the election where an FBI guy was approached by a senior State Department official who was trying to get one of Secretary Clinton's emails declassified. And you know, the Republicans in Congress threw up their arms and said, that's collusion, that's criminal, I'm going to launch an investigation. That kind of collusion and crosstalk between agencies like involved in counterterrorism, in this case on a counterterrorism issue, is exactly what you want to promote. You want, you know, if you start criminalizing crosstalk between the agencies because of this hyper-partisanship that, you know, grips Washington, you'll very quickly see this collaborative style of warfare that I've talked about disappear because no one's going to want to, you know, be charged with colluding with another agency. So that worries me. A lot of these guys come back from war zones and they're elevated to senior positions to sort of instill the lessons they learned at war, and they find that too disruptive. That happened to Mike Flynn at the Defense Intelligence Agency. That worries me too. So it remains to be seen if we can retain this sort of style of war that came out of a sort of wartime mindset at a time when America has sort of doesn't seem to think it's at war anymore.
James Kitfield's new book is called Twilight Warriors, the soldiers, spies, and special agents who are revolutionizing the American way of war. James, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thanks for making time for us.
Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Alan Roberts. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones from Javier Hiribet. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington, and I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.